Hi, this is Bill Radke. Welcome to KUOW's The Record. We're live tweeting this hour at KUOW. Last night, President Trump announced his choice to fill the empty seat on the U.S. Supreme Court.
I have selected an individual whose qualities define, really, and I mean closely define, what we're looking for. Judge Gorsuch has outstanding legal skills, a brilliant mind, tremendous discipline, and has earned bipartisan support.
Neil Gorsuch is a federal appeals court judge appointed by President George W. Bush. Gorsuch has been called an originalist, someone who gives a lot of weight to the original intent of the constitutional framers. And now his appointment is up to the U.S. Senate. Joining us live with more is NPR's lead digital political reporter, Jessica Taylor. Welcome, Jessica.
Hi there.
So President Trump says Judge Gorsuch got bipartisan support when he was confirmed to lower courts. Can he expect the same this time around?
I think there are very different standards that the Senate applies to a lower court, an appeals court judge, than they do to the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court. And also, you know, we're talking about very different times there. He was confirmed about 10 years ago. And while, you know, the Senate was very partisan in that regard, still, it's nothing like what we're seeing now. And it is very fraught. There are Democrats who are still very upset over the way that President Obama's nominee to this seat was treated, Merrick Garland. They really feel like this should have been their seat, given when Justice Scalia passed away. And so I think that you're going to see a vote largely along partisan lines.
Yeah, so we'll talk a little more about the Merrick Garland dust-up and why that matters now. I want to know first, Jessica, traditionally, Supreme Court nominees need the votes of 60 senators. What are the odds that Gorsuch has those votes as it is?
They're pretty good, actually. You have some senators like Jeff Merkley of Oregon who have said that they're going to filibuster this. They're going to try to prevent that 60, that vote from coming up. But you also have a lot of red state Democrats, particularly ones that are up in 2018, like Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, that they may not want to take such a partisan vote and at least move forward, even if they may vote against him on the actual confirmation vote. Trying to block this would, be very unprecedented.
And today, President Trump said if Democrats were to hold up Gorsuch's confirmation, he would tell Republicans to, quote, go nuclear. Remind us what that means.
This would be where they essentially eliminate that 60 vote threshold, where it just would take a simple majority in order to confirm them. Now, Democrats did this a few years ago. Harry Reid did, and they removed the 60 vote threshold for other executive branch appointments like cabinet members, which is what we're seeing now, and for other lower court judgeships. And so now this is really the only place where it still applies when we're talking about nominations like this. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has been he does not want to employ this. You know, Democrats sort of saw it come back and bite them back when they've done it, because really now they'd like to have that 60 vote threshold back. So this would be a very big move if they did it. But I think that probably it's still likely to hold.
And what is it, Jessica, that worries Democrats the most about Judge Gorsuch joining the U.S. Supreme Court? What are the issues that are going to be big and that he's likely to let them down on?
Well, I think that, he has written some opinions on challenges to the Obamacare, the contraception mandate. He sided with proponents of religious freedom on that. He has weighed in on court-assisted suicide. He's actually written a book on that. And I think it's just this originalist sort of textualist approach that he has that really is not in line with what many liberals believe. But that being said, he is replacing someone like Scalia, who was sort of his mentor, sort of ideological, almost very much like him. And so the makeup of the court, if he is confirmed, would not change that much. I think that you're seeing Democrats maybe like, okay, maybe we shouldn't make this our big fight. Maybe it becomes later on if someone like Justice Ginsburg or Justice Kennedy, where if they are replaced by someone who is far more conservative, that would shift the makeup of the court much more.
Yes. Now we're getting into political calculation, talking with NPR's lead digital political reporter, Jessica Taylor. You mentioned Democrats angry about when President Obama chose Merrick Garland for the Supreme Court. Republicans wouldn't even consider Garland, just undermining the president's historic ability to fill the Supreme Court. But that's over now. So as the Democrats figure out their next move. First of all, what would they gain now by roadblocking Gorsuch's nomination?
I think it would just set this very partisan tone going forward and really sort of draw a line in the sand. Like, you know, you have their base, though, is very upset over over Trump in general and all of these executive orders that he has proposed. And I think, you know, you're going to see some, I think, sort of grassroots bubbling up that they really want them to really have gridlock, to sort of not move this forward and stuff too. So that could really come into play. But, you know, like I said before, I think that you have some other senators who have been there a long time, and they're going to say, you know, maybe we want to keep this fight down the road. Maybe we don't sort of want to use up all our political capital here.
Yes. The idea being that there might be a new opening on the Supreme Court, and maybe they want to oppose that nominee.
Yeah, I think that, you know, maybe it's sort of we've got bigger fish to fry in it. And, you know, this is someone like Gorsuch. This is sort of someone who you would have seen President Bush nominate. You would have seen any other of the Republican nominees if they had won nominate. Certainly he's not someone that Hillary Clinton would have nominated, but he is qualified. They've said that. You know, he has certainly all of the qualifications. I think that you are going to see him drilled very sharply on his opinions. I think that's where they're not going to pull any punches. And that could sort of, you know, maybe sway a few votes and things, too. But like I said, some of these Democrats, especially in red states that are up in 2018, I think that they're more likely than not to probably back him when it comes down to it.
Okay, Jessica, finally, anything else that you'll be watching that we ought to be thinking about as this confirmation process does or doesn't move forward on Neil Gorsuch?
Like I said, I think sort of watch where sort of the energy is and grassroots, if there are protests that rise up against this. You know, we've seen so many over just the past 12 days since Trump has been in office. And, you know, if there's something big that comes out against him. But I mean, it takes a lot to block a Supreme Court nominee. The last one that was voted down was Robert Bork back in 87. Of course, George Bush had to withdraw Harriet Myers. And then, you know, I'm not really sure how to classify Garland since he wasn't even brought up and things, too. But, you know, I think that you're going to see Democrats, I think, really just want to sort of grill him on this. But like I said, I really think they're probably going to wait and have a larger battle if another seat does come open. But I think a lot of them are praying that maybe, you know, some of these other older justices who are in their 80s could wait a few years at least.
Right. There's been jokes about having Kennedy or other justices take their vitamins and hang in there.
Yeah.
Jessica Taylor, lead digital political reporter for NPR. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you, Bill.
Telling us that we may see protests again, this time around a Supreme Court nominee, whether inside the Capitol building or protest outside it. Finally, one more note from D.C. A couple of Republican senators have announced opposition to Trump's choice for Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Senators Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, both Republicans, saying they cannot support DeVos, a wealthy Republican donor and a school choice activist. We'll follow that for you as well here on KUOW Seattle. You're with KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. You know, as fast as Seattle is growing, it really doesn't have many children. Sure, the schools are overcrowded and there are strollers everywhere, but as a percentage, the number of kids in Seattle is really low. There is not much new housing that's designed for families. Still, some parents are finding a way to stay in the city anyway. From KUOW's Region of Boom team, Joshua McNichols reports.
Amalia Layton helped Seattle analyze its lack of children.
The only other major city in the U.S. that had lower percentage of children was San Francisco.
Layton is standing on Lake City Way to show me why Seattle is becoming almost as childless as San Francisco. She points to a big apartment building. It's mostly studios and one bedrooms, which aren't big enough for families. And in the neighborhood beyond, it's not like developers are putting up many more single-family homes. There's very little vacant land. Because of that, we're in danger of becoming a city of only young tech workers.
But even tech people have kids someday, and so we're hoping that even they can be able to stay in the city with family-sized housing and that they have options as well.
There are things we could do. Seattle could allow more duplexes in neighborhoods with single-family homes that would let two families live where there used to be one. Or the city could require developers to build more 2- and 3-bedroom apartments. Or you could do what 9 families on Capitol Hill did when they went ahead and built housing for themselves. I'm at the Capitol Hill Urban Co-Housing Building. Several families are preparing dinner in their shared dining room. At least they were until they cranked the music and started dancing, kids and adults together. It's a little island of community centered around families in one of the most child-free cities in the nation. Here's 16-year-old Ciela Chavez Gilbride.
I think you learn a lot of things being in a city. It's a lot more like, I don't know, I like having, there's a lot more opportunities for experiences and for like culture and like going out to see like museums and stuff like that. And like, I don't know, I can't imagine living anywhere else. And also, these people are great.
Building this housing themselves made these families dig deep into their wallets. They had to pay for the land and construction costs. It took years to pull off. It's just one example of how some families are finding ways to stay in the city. John Scholes heads the Downtown Seattle Association. He lives downtown with his partner and kids.
You get creative. I know some families who use a closet for a bedroom or a nursery. And lots of families like we do, you know, and we have kids of opposite sex that are the same age and they share a room and they will do that for a while. And so you get creative about how you use space.
These aren't just anecdotes either. In downtown Seattle, the neighborhood you might expect to be the least friendly to children, the population of kids is increasing at twice the rate as the general population. It's not enough yet to turn around Greater Seattle's slide into childlessness. But who knows? People want to be part of a community these days. Here's Kate Erickson, who lives at that co-housing building on Capitol Hill.
In this particular time, when I think people have felt sad and discouraged the last few months in regards to politics and the world, it's been amazing to have this community to come home to at night, for everyone to be able to sort of come together to make dinner or talk, and to lean on each other that way, has been really healthy for our family.
These families have found a way to live together in the city. And despite everything that's going on in politics, they can't help thinking about the future as they watch each other's children blow out the candles on their birthday cakes. On Capitol Hill, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
KUOW Seattle, and here is another effect of living in a very crowded city. We don't have room to bury people, not much space for cemetery plots. You can cremate someone's remains, but that's not as eco-friendly as you might think. So my next guest would like you to consider something else: letting your body decompose into soil, so your loved ones can use that soil for something new. Katrina Spade is founder of the Urban Death Project, and she says she got her inspiration from something ranchers have been doing for years: composting dead livestock.
And the basic principle is you take a body, like a, say, an animal carcass, like a cow, that's died of natural causes, and you cover it with a high carbon material such as wood chips. And so our bodies are high in nitrogen. Wood chips are high in carbon. And as you probably know, that ratio is critical for composting.
Right. If you have a compost bin, you're familiar with that.
Yeah. So essentially what we're doing is creating the right environment for the beneficial bacteria and microbes to come and do what they would do anyway in nature.
There are centuries of history of us doing other things with bodies. So why would you want a recomposition?
You know, the history of the funeral industry is fascinating. The two most common methods of disposition, cremation and conventional burial, came to us out of sort of a mix of like historical happenstance and industry interest. They're not really meaningful to a lot of people anymore. And so on the one hand, they've been happening for a fairly long time. Cremation started up in this culture in the 1960s, and conventional burial started up just after the Civil War, the way we know it today, with embalming and caskets. On the one hand, that's not a very long time. On the other hand, it's something that we're used to, but there's no reason those have to be the only two options.
Well, what's wrong with the funeral industry?
Here's the thing about the current funeral industry. Number one, it's a for-profit industry for the most part and really does rely on selling consumables and services to people during their most vulnerable time. So, you know, when you're grieving, you are, I read the study once that grieving is like being inebriated. It's like being drunk. You can't make a decision. It's really hard to think clearly. You're clouded by the feelings of sadness and of losing someone. And that's the moment where you go into a funeral home and you're pressured to buy the fanciest casket to honor your loved one.
Yeah, I've been in that room full of caskets.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason that death care needs to be that way. We've set it up this way, we've accepted it as a culture, but there's no reason it has to remain.
Well, burial is still meaningful to some people, and for a lot of others, I thought cremation was the hipper thing to do. What's wrong with that?
Well, I'll say first that my baseline feeling is if you love conventional burial, you want to be embalmed and buried in a casket, by all means, go for it. This is about providing more options because so few people really want that. As for cremation, it's become the default. I think it's less that people love fire, for example, or the idea of ashes, than that they are interested in something that feels like a more sustainable option, is less complicated and less expensive.
And less fussy.
It's less fussy, but you know what? I've heard so many people say, when I die, don't make a fuss. But I have to push back because I think if there's any moment in our lives when we should make a fuss, it's probably when someone dies.
Yeah. So to people who think that, oh, you don't care about the funeral ritual, your idea of recomposing is very ritualistic.
Yeah. Well, so I started designing this idea not with the concept of composting humans, but actually with the question of, what could our cities provide us in terms of spaces and ritual for this huge momentous event of death that we're doing a terrible job marking and having ceremony around? We don't really have guidance for grieving in this culture. And so the project began with the goal of creating new types of spaces in our cities that honor the dead and support the grieving. And then it just evolved in part because my friend called me to tell me about this amazing process of livestock composting. But the project has evolved to be both a system and a ritual.
And the ritual involves, so that it's I'm picturing a vertical like a tower, and you carry your loved one up a ramp, a circular ramp, up to the top and place him or her in the wood chips.
Yep.
Right. And then the body over time sort of filters down. Well, like kind of like a compost bin. I get my compost from the bottom of the bin, mm-hmm. open it up at the bottom in a few weeks, and it's soil. Is that it?
That's pretty close. So what happened was we designed the system in the first place to be vertical because we were thinking about cities and land use and the fact that half of the world's population lives in cities now, and we can't give an individual grave to each person that dies. So we think, okay, it's obvious that this system, this ongoing process, should start with a vertical structure. And that bodies would be laid in on top, covered with wood chips, and over time as they decomposed and finished material is taken out of the bottom, you have this ongoing downward moving process. And so then I thought, well, of course, ramps would be a beautiful way to bring the body to the top of the core. And so the ritual evolved from the practicality of the technical, which I think for me was one of the special things that happened was, okay, and now you've got the living, breathing, grieving, carrying the body, using their own energy, carrying this inert object, their loved one, to the top of the core. And by laying it into this bed of wood chips, are beginning its transformation. And that transformation actually creates a new type of energy. And so this kind of winding of a watch, if you will, where up and around the core is the winding, and then you've set in motion a new process, became the ritual.
You know, Katrina, I don't find human composting the least bit gross or weird, but we're unusual. I mean, why do you think most people want the casket and the embalming and the makeup or the scattering of the ashes?
All right, I've got two things to say to you about that. The first is that cremation just this year has surpassed conventional burial as the most popular form of disposition in the U.S. It was at basically zero in 1960. So over 60 years, we see it go from nothing to the most popular form in the U.S. In Seattle, I think the rate is something like 90% of people are cremated. So That is to say that conventional burial is pretty quickly losing its interest for people. And the other thing is where you just said, we're different. I like human composting, but probably no one else does.
Oh,
I like human composting.
You hear that a lot.
I hear that all the time. I can't tell you how many times people have said to me, well, I get it and I really love it and I would want that for my body, but no one else probably would.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair.
It's
anecdotal. So maybe it's just not that weird, you know?
It might not be. I have to be honest, like kind of everything we do with dead bodies is a little bit weird. We're not used to talking about that stuff. We're not used to seeing it. And so it's just all going to feel a little off.
But you don't see a future where we just, I mean, why have a shroud? Why not a naked body? There's all kinds of elaborate things we do for no real reason. We don't have to have even the whole ritual you're talking about. Couldn't you just, you know, roll the body under your tree?
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. What we're proposing isn't just like, let's simply take care of the physical thing that is the dead human body. We've got a lot more that we're trying to bring to death care. And I guess that's part of the reason that the project has been able to be so successful this far and get people behind it is because it's bringing more than just a process.
You said you do want to give meaning to this passage. How does the recomposting process give us meaning or dignity or anything?
Well, I'm not religious, and neither is my family and most of my closest friends. And so the closest thing I have to a faith really has to do with nature somehow. For me, it's very comforting to imagine that after I die, I can rejoin the ecosystem in a sort of pure way, stop being human. So for me, there's just more meaning in decomposing naturally and being used again to grow life.
What do you want to grow?
That's a good question. I think something kind of prickly, like a nettle or like something sour, like, you know, limes or something like that.
Really?
What about you?
I'm not a pot smoker.
Oh, I've had a number of people say, I'm going to be marijuana.
Sure, understandable.
My buddies can smoke me up.
Yeah. I do like a little rosemary with my chicken.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. I wonder if you get this a lot. I feel calmed when I imagine this tower and my atoms filtering down and going into your lemon tree.
I think it is very calming for many people. I think that's what's been such a draw. It's comforting. It's also just a known entity. Okay, that's what will happen to me after I die.
How has your feeling about your death, our deaths, how's that changed?
We truly are all part of this cycle of life and death. And when you start to be able to accept that, it's a real freeing, I think. But since working on this project, I've realized that death can be quite beautiful and that working in it gives one a better appreciation of being alive.
Katrina Spade, I'm happy you're alive with me for now, and thanks for this conversation.
Thank you.
Katrina Spade founded and directs the Urban Death Project. She is going to be building a prototype on the campus of Washington State University this spring. What do you think? Are you interested in composting your remains? How would you like your body to be used? We're tweeting out a helpful link now at KUOW. So join us, join the conversation there on Twitter at KUOW. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Okay, white Seattle liberals, this next conversation is for all of us, but especially for you. Anti-racist activist Tim Wise came to Seattle to give a sold-out talk at the University of Washington. Tim Wise led campus anti-apartheid protests in the 80s. He fought to defeat David Duke's Senate campaign in the 90s. He's written books like Dear White America, Letter to a New Minority. Tim Wise and I started out talking about white privilege. What is it? Who has it? And what do we get wrong about it?
I think it's often misunderstood. I think people hear the word privilege, they assume we're talking about money. there certainly is such a thing as class privilege, and lots of white people happen to have class privilege. But when we talk about white privilege, it really isn't about that, right? It's about this sort of historically embedded set of advantages, opportunities, head starts, general immunities from negative treatment on the basis of race, which those of us called white tend to have, and those who are not called white in this country tend not to have, or at least not to have in the same degree and to the same extent. Yes, obviously there are some that are materially related. Historically, whites had greater access to jobs and housing and better schooling, and that certainly allowed whites to develop greater wealth, net worth. Right now, the typical white family, 15 times the net worth of the typical black family. That obviously is related to, you know, a history of unearned and unequal opportunity. But I think there are others that we want to focus on first before we even talk about the material ones. It's the psychological advantage of knowing that for the most part, your race is not going to be used as a marker of suspicion or negativity by law enforcement, by employers, by real estate agents, by bankers, loan officers. Being able to go through the day more or less not really thinking about your racial identity, which of course is not something people of color can do. So it's the privilege of being oblivious to your identity, and certainly the privilege of being oblivious to the effect of racism in the country on other people who are not white.
You said there are plenty of examples these days of white privilege. Have you seen an example today?
Well, I mean, Donald Trump is still in the White House, so I suppose the answer to that is yes. My guess is we all know that if Barack Obama had been caught on tape saying the things that Donald Trump said about women, or about anyone else for that matter, but certainly in terms of how he treats women, that he would never have been elected president, because it would have triggered all of these racial stereotypes about black male hypersexuality and sexual assault. So Donald Trump can get away with that. So I do think white privilege is certainly implicated in the election. It's also implicated in what we're seeing in terms of policing around the country. Stop and frisk, something that Donald Trump has said he would like to do nationally, which was done in New York. 88% of the people that were stopped were people of color. 94% of them didn't even get a ticket for jaywalking because they'd broken no law. Only 1.2% had drugs on them. 0.1% had guns. So it had nothing to do with stopping crime, but it did have a lot to do with controlling black populations. And if I was a white New Yorker during the period of stop and frisk, I would have had the privilege of knowing that I wasn't going to be the target, even though the data says I'm just as likely to have drugs, just as likely to use drugs. And interestingly enough, depending on the age group, sometimes white folks in various boroughs of the city of New York are just as likely to carry weapons. That's a privilege to not have to worry about that, you know?
You talk about how white privilege doesn't necessarily equal money, and yet we have some KUOW listeners, some who I hear from, who will hear that and still say, privilege is not white, it's privilege. I wish I had privilege.
Right, right. Well, but we all have certain types of privilege, right? To act like you don't have privilege because you're not wealthy is absurd. And let me just make the most obvious sort of analogy.
What about if you're not just not wealthy, but you're struggling?
Even if you're struggling. I mean, let's think about this for a minute. You know, my family didn't have any money. We grew up in an 800 square foot apartment from the day I was 3 years old until the day I went off to college. We didn't have advantages, but I was still treated better in the schools. I was treated by teachers as someone who was capable, put in honors classes and advanced classes, even when the black kids and other kids of color were not, even when they were just as bright as I was. I wasn't a very good student, but I was always put in those classes because I was seen as having all of this potential. I was able to get away with things in the face of cops, you know, whether it was underage drinking or actual drug use, that very few people of color my age would have been able to get away with. And I was able to do that in spite of not having money and in spite of quite a significant amount of economic struggle. But the real point about privilege, if you just think about it for a second, take it out of the money realm, right? Those of us who are able-bodied, I think any able-bodied person who's being honest would have to say we have certain advantages, aka privileges, vis-a-vis people who are disabled. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't able-bodied people who are poor. There are. There are also disabled people who aren't poor, who maybe inherited money, have money in the bank, enough for good health care or round-the-clock care. But the fact that there are disabled people who might be rich and able-bodied people who might be struggling doesn't change the fact that on balance, it pays to be able-bodied. And that is the point when it comes to white privilege. Are there white people who struggle? Of course. Are there people of color who are doing really well economically? Of course. But on balance, race matters. And to be a member of the dominant group in any society obviously gives you certain legs up in general. The fact that there might be exceptions to the rule doesn't disprove the rule. It proves the rule. It's like, you know, smoking causes cancer. That's not arguable among rational people. And yet you might have an Aunt Polly who's 93 years old, smoked for 70 years, doesn't even have a cough. It doesn't disprove the correlation.
It's like poker. You can lose your chips through bad luck or bad decisions, but you still got extra chips for being white.
Right.
Some white listeners are saying, okay, yes, I'm privileged. What am I supposed to do about it? I'm already liberal.
Right. Well, I think the key about having it, right, other than acknowledging it, which is an intellectual exercise, I suppose, is you have to figure out ways to deploy that privilege in a more responsible and more accountable way. How can I use the access that I have? Sort of try to keep in mind all the ways that even the most liberal of people can fall into the traps that have been set for us by a culture that has taught us all of these stereotypes, and we've learned them. We've learned them very well.
I'm talking with anti-racist activist and writer Tim Wise. How about this theory, Tim? White people turned to Donald Trump because people like you make them feel defensive. You're the political correctness that they think Trump is standing up to.
Well, I'm sure there are some people who would make that argument, and I've certainly heard that argument. And I'm not going to deny that there are certain people within the sort of orbit of the anti-racist left who have gone about making these arguments in ways that do, in fact, make folks feel sort of crappy. I make no bones about that. I try very hard not to. In fact, even just describing to you white privilege, you know, I'm making the point. I know white folks struggle. There are millions of white folks who are struggling. My argument is actually one that's very compassionate towards them, because what I'm really saying is I think part of the reason people turn to Trump is that when their jobs began to disappear, when their communities in the Rust Belt and Appalachia and coal country began to disappear, they were the ones who were especially unprepared for that level of economic decline. People of color have always been used to the idea that no matter how hard they worked, they might not have a job. Black and brown folks know what double-digit unemployment is like. Black and brown folks know what it is to have to hustle and scrape. But unfortunately, a lot of working-class white folks in this country for generations, because of relative privilege, not because of money privilege, but the relative privilege of whiteness, and maybe also masculinity, were able, if they were white men, to say, you know what, as long as you got a strong back and can lift stuff, you'll always have a job. Now, there isn't a black man in America who's ever had the luxury of assuming that. There's not a Latino male who's ever had the luxury of assuming that, because they knew that their job access was contingent on whether or not the employers were racist and would give them a shot. But white men had the luxury of being lulled to sleep to assume the economy would never change. So by God, my daddy worked in the coal mine, his daddy worked in the coal mine, his daddy worked in the coal mine, I'm working in the coal mine, and I want my son to work in the coal mine, regardless of whether the son wants to. That's a certain type of privilege that lets you down, because what it does is it doesn't prepare you for an economy that is shifting. It doesn't prepare you for the decline of manufacturing. It doesn't prepare you for an economy rooted in financialization. So I think in a way, the very privilege that usually gives you advantages can also set you up. And I think it's important for working class white folks to realize that when you turn to Donald Trump, a walking, talking opiate that you think is going to block your pain in a global economy, all the stuff that really needs to be done to deal with the fact that the wealthiest 0.1% of Americans owns the same amount of stuff as the bottom 90%, that's not going to change with a billionaire in office who has already told you he's going to cut taxes on the wealthiest people. So we're turning to this opiate because privilege is telling us we got to keep above those people. If we can just stay above the Mexicans, if we can stay above the, you know, the black folks, if we can stay above the Muslims from the quote unquote Middle East, we're fine. And meanwhile, those same working class white folks are going to continue to struggle. It's happening now. Donald Trump is basically saying he's going to cut their health care, and they're acting like, well, what? You're going to cut? Yes, he told you he was going to cut the health care upon which you depend. And they're shocked. Apparently, they just thought he was going to hurt those people over there who were coming over this fictive border. And I think what that tells you is that to some extent, whiteness giveth and whiteness taketh away, right? In the sense that it makes you feel special. It gives you what W.E.B. Du Bois called the psychological wage, right? The idea that, well, I might not have much, but at least I'm not black. I might not have much, but at least I'm not brown. And that may be the only wage you have with this guy, because I don't think there's any question that the privileges that he's offering are not going to pan out for an awful lot of people.
You came here to talk at the University of Washington. Do you give the same talk in other parts of the country outside of blue bubble university towns?
Oh, Lord, yeah.
Because we like to think we're different than those other people.
Well, you know, I live in the South. I've always lived in the South. I speak all over the country. I've spoken in every state. What I found is that for the most part, the struggles are the same. The universities are dealing with the same issues. The high school kids are dealing with the same issues. The local community, the religious institutions, the corporation. I don't think there's any difference in the sort of quantitative amount of racism, let's say, in the South versus the Pacific Northwest. I don't think there's a difference in the quantitative amount of racism in Tennessee, where I'm from and where I live, as opposed to California, which is where I've been all week. What I do think is the qualitative way in which it plays out is different. So in the South, there's certainly both historically and today, I would say a raw type of blatant racism that is very recognizable, that everybody can easily condemn as racism, right? And then in the Pacific Northwest and the West Coast generally, and maybe the Northeast, there's a much more what, you know, certain scholars, Eduardo Bonilla Silva and others, have called colorblind racism, or racism without racist, right? This idea that nice people who are not racist at their core, not what we think of as racist in a bigoted sense, right, nonetheless have this sort of colorblind racism, this ability to just sort of obscure the existence of race at all, to look through people of color, to act as if race isn't even in the picture. And of course, if I ignore the way that the role that race has on black and brown folks in Seattle or in Los Angeles or in the Bay Area, then I'm ignoring their lived experience, and I don't see when they experience police brutality disproportionately. I don't see when they experience inequality in the school systems. You know, we've seen in places like Washington State. I've been coming up here for over 20 years, and in 1997, it was Washington State, or 98, right, was when Washington State got rid of affirmative action with I-200. That didn't happen in Mississippi. That didn't happen in Tennessee. That wasn't Alabama or South Carolina. That was Washington State. Right before that, California did the same thing with Prop 209. After that, Michigan did a similar thing. So all of these blue states are the ones where the white folks got together and said, we gotta stop all this unfair preference being given to people of color, even though, of course, you look at who had the best jobs, you look at who had the best college slots, you look at who got the contracts in this state, for instance, and it's been many years, but as I recall, 91% of government contracts in the state of Washington were going to white male-owned businesses, but they're screaming and yelling about reverse discrimination. So,
but in Seattle, we think it's the rural whites of Washington State who are doing that screaming and yelling. What do you find in your Seattle
except that
experience?
If you looked at the vote, the way it went down, even in Seattle, there was either a slight majority of whites who voted for that proposition or a very large plurality. It wasn't as if, you know, liberal Seattle rose up and said, oh, we have to stop the folks in the rural communities and, you know, in east of the mountains. The white folks generally in this state, including white women who were told are so much more progressive and will always come to the defense of these white women, went and voted to get rid of affirmative action in this community as well. And the same thing happened in California, even in the larger blue, quote unquote, metropolitan statistical area.
Do you find that in your talks, in your question and answer session? I'm curious, what's your experience? What's the racial awareness and level of honesty in Seattle compared to other places?
Well, it depends. I mean, there are certainly some amazing, and have been for a very long time, some amazing anti-racist folks up here doing really good stuff in the community. And I mean, both people of color and white allies working in solidarity with those folks of color. But I do believe that Seattle, Portland, and all throughout the West Coast and in certain northeastern, quote unquote, liberal cities, there is the ability to be lulled to sleep, and to lull oneself to sleep, if you're white in particular, by the sort of political liberality, right? The fact that you, quote unquote, vote the right way, whatever that means, or the fact that, you know, you eat organic.
What do you mean, whatever it means?
You know, I mean, we don't know what it means, because ultimately voting the right, we could have arguments about whether or not voting for, let's say, a Democrat for a congressional seat or a Senate seat, or, you know, whether that really changes anything. Now, obviously, you know, I would make the argument that in the vast majority of instances, that's the choice that you might make if you're liberal, but it in and of itself, it doesn't really change. You know, the larger political structure is not changed by necessarily who's elected and who isn't. And of course, those of us on the left also have debates about, you know, what role do we play in the electoral process. So that's what I mean by it. I mean, I was just in California and I was talking to people who said, you know, it's like, well, I'm not going to write my congressperson because I know they're already progressive. And so there's no, you know, so then
we have those conversations.
Right.
Here.
So then what do you do if that's not what you're going to do? And I agree, it's not really necessarily helpful when you've got someone who's already on your side and you know the way they're going to vote on, let's say, a cabinet nominee. You got to get out and do stuff that's considerably more community rooted than that. You have to actually have some guts to stand up. Now, there are some people in this community, you know, I'll talk folks, the teachers at Garfield High School is a really good example of this, who in the last couple of years have been very adamant, right, about standing up to state testing and saying, we're not doing this and we dare you to fire us all. They tried to starve them out and tried to cut their funds or tried to, you know, keep them from being paid or whatever it was. But these are folks who have stood up and said, we are going to put ourselves on the line, both white educators and educators of color on behalf of this community. That's the kind of courage that it takes. And you do see that in Seattle, but then you also see other schools that don't do that. And the vast majority of teachers aren't doing that. And the vast majority of white folks aren't in the streets dealing with the very disproportionate policing of black and brown communities that has been a problem in this city and all throughout the state for years. So I feel like, in a sense, the danger is not that Seattle's going to become a reactionary place. The problem is that that liberalism is the kind that kills by virtue of its silence and what it misses. And I had a conversation many years ago, the first time I went to the Bay Area, with a black guy who I've come to know very well since, but at the time had never met him before really or had a conversation. He said, look, this is the most racist place I've ever lived. And he had lived in the South most of his life. He was saying the Bay Area was the most racist place. And I just listened to him and he gave me examples, you know, of just sort of the way that people looked through him, the way that he was dismissed, the way sometimes he faced even blatant racism, but more often subtle types, but constant. And I would tell white people, white liberals, they say, well, that's the craziest thing. San Francisco's heaven. You know, it's the greatest place ever. And yet that city has a long history of racial oppression of black and brown peoples. Oakland, long history of racial oppression of peoples of color. And I don't think that's a history most white folks know about, particularly if they're transplants who've come to take advantage of sort of the hipster vibe and the fact that it's a cool place to be or whatever, or their job opportunities here, you know.
You talked about a black man having someone look through him. What's going on there, do you think, in that moment when a white liberal looks right through, as you said, a black man in a way that he's not seeing in the South?
I think what the white liberal does in that instance and what he meant was, you know, that they just sort of, when he said look through them, they just sort of looked at him in a way that they didn't credit his experience. To them, I think they maybe thought it was progressive to think to themselves, well, we don't even see you as black, you know.
Explain that, would you?
Well, to that individual, you know, his blackness has a lot to do with his experience of the world. It's not everything, right? We're not only one-dimensional, but the fact that he's black is going to affect the way he has experienced everything from policing to the job market to schooling, just like me being white is going to affect the same thing. It's not the only thing. I'm also male. I'm also straight. I'm cisgendered. I'm also Jewish in the South. That's going to have a different effect. I'm also 5'8" in a tall man's world going through airports with guys that are over 6 feet tall. So I have a multiplicity of identities and they all shape who I am. When we don't notice that, however, when we reduce ourselves to just this sort of like notion of an individual, we end up, I think, putting to the side in a really dismissive way the lived experience of marginalized peoples. And so that's what he was talking about when he talks about being looked through. And it's one of the reasons that there has been a reverse migration over the last 25 to 30 years of black folks leaving the Northeast, leaving the upper Midwest, leaving the West Coast, and moving back to the South. That's why Charlotte and Atlanta have become these sort of meccas of urban black, middle class, college educated folks who've gone elsewhere. They've gotten some opportunity. Maybe they've done okay. And then they've moved back. And people say, why would you go back there? Well, you know, and they'll tell you. They'd rather deal with the racism that they know and that's obvious, where they can see it coming. They know exactly, you know, how to sort of cope with that, as opposed to this much more dismissive racism. So again, it's not a quantitative difference. It's a qualitative difference just in terms of how racism looks in the Pacific Northwest versus, let's say, how it looks in the South.
Final question. You're leaving Seattle. How do you know you did something? You accomplished something?
Well, you know, it's hard because obviously one speech, and I've given hundreds of speeches in the state over the 20 years that I've been coming up here. No one speech or even 100 speeches is going to in and of itself make the difference. I would be absurd to even attempt to have that impact. The impact is going to be the kind of work that's being done in the community right now, whether it's by the Movement for Black Lives, whether it's by the folks in Surge showing up for racial justice, a white anti-racist solidarity group. They're out in the community all the time doing stuff. The fact that we're going to have a full house tonight tells me that there is certainly an interest and a hunger to talk about this kind of stuff and to figure out how to mobilize. You know, last night I had 1,000 people in Santa Barbara, or 2 nights ago, 1,000 people in Santa Barbara. So it's very obvious that that's not just me. It's not just people coming out to hear me. That's people who are coming out to hear about some concepts and some ideas that they can see every time they open up their computer, turn on the television, or open a newspaper, are front and center in this country. So I'll know that it's made an impact, not necessarily my speech, but all the work that is happening in places like Seattle, when, you know, 6 months from now, we continue to have the kind of mobilization that we just saw in city after city after city with the march the day after the inauguration. If that energy continues, and if we can focus it on issues of oppression like racism and the things that I'll be talking about tonight, then I will know that something, you know, real is afoot.
Tim Wise, anti-racist activist, writer, welcome back to Seattle, and thanks for coming in.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle 94.9 News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting this show at KUOW. Now, through this political season, we've occasionally heard the opinions of Seattle Seahawks players, some of them. Doug Baldwin, Richard Sherman, Michael Bennett, they've spoken out about race and crime and politics. Then there's the quarterback. Russell Wilson seems so neutral, so inoffensive, so corporate friendly. But yesterday, in a video posted to Facebook Live, Russell Wilson is getting his hair cut and he's talking to the camera and he actually talks politics.
Everybody has the right to choose who they want to vote for, but this thing's getting out of hand. It's getting out of hand, people. I don't care who you vote for. I voted for Hillary. When you think about it, it's only been, 2 weeks? Right? 2 weeks or even less?
10 days. Or what's today, the 31st?
Yeah. So last Friday.
11 days, yeah.
We got to attack this issue here. Basically, I think that when you think about all the negativity that's happened within, a 10-day period, however many days it's been, it's already too much. It's already crazy. It's already affecting people's hearts and souls and lives in such a negative way, in my opinion.
Russell Wilson talking about the Trump presidency, and he mentions the airport protests he's seeing and the negativity and how we have to love everybody. And then he says this.
I don't even know if he's going to be able to last 4 years, in my opinion. You don't want to wish bad upon anybody, because if he doesn't last 4 years, that means that something went wrong. So hopefully nothing goes wrong any more than what it's already doing. But it's just been a crazy 10 days already. And, Barack! Come back, Barack.
That would be nice.
Come back, Barack. Trump won't last 4 years. Maybe Russell Wilson is awakening. Or maybe he just knows the Super Bowl is this weekend and he knows you're thinking about what happened exactly 2 years ago today.
Russell is taking his time.
Now, you know what happened. We don't have to relive that again. Maybe Russell Wilson doesn't want to relive it either. He's getting political now so that on Sunday, as the Patriots are playing in the Super Bowl again, you'll be thinking about what was lost, but not this loss.
Russell, look, throws inside. Oh, my God!
No. This loss.
Barack! Come back, Barack.
You think Russell Wilson's going to get a tweet from President Trump any day? This is KUOW's The Record. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Worshippers are returning to the scene of Sunday's shooting at a mosque in Quebec City, Canada. A mosque official says he wanted to open the center to the public so people can see what worshippers had to suffer. Joining us live now is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Vaughn, what is the latest we know about what happened at that mosque?
Well, we're still... Canadian authorities still piecing together, but essentially during prayers on the weekend, a gunman came in and shot, killed six worshipers in the back, injured another 19, four people still in hospital, two in critical condition. The shooter, a young man, Andre Bissonnette, a political science student, fairly active on the internet. He's been charged with six counts of first-degree murder, five of attempted murder, and Canadian authorities are still assembling evidence that would be necessary to charge him with terrorist murder as well. We do have a law for that in Canada, but you need evidence that, in addition to killing people, your intent was to terrorize a whole community.
You said the suspect has been active on the internet. Do we know why the shooter did this?
The answer is nothing that can lead to that charge of terrorism yet, but, I mean, our authorities have said it's clearly a terrorist attack. It was intended to intimidate this community. From what we've seen on the internet and Facebook pages and the like, this young man had linked up with, followed various racist, anti-immigrant sites around the world, had followed that, so there's certainly evidence. But the other thing is the mosque has given, you just mentioned that off the top, they've given people a tour of the place today so people can see the carnage that was wreaked in there. But the other thing is that we now had a witness come forward who says they're quite sure this guy had visited the mosque before. So whether he was casing the joint or whether he went in thinking he might do something and backed away, we don't know that yet. He's only made one appearance in court, and no evidence is presented yet.
Vaughn, what have relations been like in Quebec between Muslims and non-Muslims?
Well, I think up to this point, you'd say pretty good. There have been, you know, there have been some terrorist attacks and terrorist incidents and charges in Canada, but about a quarter of all Canada's Muslims live in Quebec. The province of Quebec controls its own immigration, and it has allowed substantial immigration from by Muslims from French-speaking colonies, so in Africa and the Middle East. Many of the people that come into Quebec are from those French-speaking countries that are also Muslims. So it's been good, but you know, I think everybody now is going back and saying, well, wait a minute, maybe the Canadian authorities have been paying a little too much attention to the threat of terrorist attacks from people aligned with ISIS or ISIL, and not enough to the potential for an anti-immigration, anti-Muslim backlash. There have been some complaints about it. The province of Quebec has also done a couple of things. Had a couple of legislative measures that were similar to some of the things that have happened in France. For example, there was a bid to ban face coverings a while ago, and there was a suggestion of banning the full burqa. So, you know, now everybody, after something like this happens, I think a country goes back and looks over the record. Did we do enough? Were we alert enough? Not that you can stop every attack by somebody crazy with a gun, we know that, but whether we thought enough about this problem in Canada and maybe addressed the potential for racial backlash as much as we should have.
On a somewhat related topic, Vaughn, would you tell us how Canada has been caught up in President Trump's immigration order?
Oh, obsessively, I would say. I mean, I think you could make the argument that we've probably gotten too caught up in it. There was a natural reaction of being shocked and appalled in Canada, and our Prime Minister was very quick to put out a tweet that was quite critical of what the President had done and to say that refugees from around the world would be welcome here. On the policy front, our bureaucrats and our public servants quickly, relatively quickly, were able to clarify that the decision in the United States wouldn't affect people in Canada with dual citizenship, even if they came from those countries. So we've had some clarification. But it's received massive coverage here. In fact, I think if you went through the media coverage of the media coverage in Canada, one of the things you would find is some people saying we probably paid more attention to Trump's moves on the weekend than we did to the shooting in Quebec City, which is kind of disturbing because, you know, in one case we're looking at what happened in another country, and in another one we should probably be thinking a lot more about what happened here. Now, that balance was corrected in the first few hours, and so I don't think that you'd say that was a fair way of characterizing the coverage over the past 72 hours, but certainly initially there was saturation coverage still going on here on Sunday of what was happening in the United States. There were protests all over Canada, again, we're not alone, around the world. Our Prime Minister, like the Prime Minister of the UK, is torn between wanting to speak out against what happened in the United States and saying it's not going to happen here.
Vancouver's Sun.
We have to deal with the United States on a whole bunch of issues.
Vaughn, that's our time, and we'll talk again next week. Thank you so much, as always.
Bye-bye, Bill.
Mm-hmm. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle News and Information.